Have you ever seen a key deer? They're the smallest subspecies of Virginia white-tailed deer. An adult deer are only about waist high to an adult person. They look stockier and their legs are shorter than other deer. Search Google for images or YouTube for videos and you'll see. What you'll also see is a lot of people with the deer, right with them, reaching their hands out for the deer to sniff, petting them, and feeding them. I'm Danielle Ross Winslow, social scientist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Human Dimensions Branch. And in this episode of the Conservation in HD podcast, we'll be discussing the impacts these interactions, particularly feeding, have on key deer and what's being done about it. First, a bit more about key deer. In the 1950s, they were on the brink of extinction. There were only about 25 individual deer left because of overhunting. So hunting bans were enforced, and in 1957, the National Key Deer Refuge was established to protect and preserve the deer and other wildlife species in the Keys. In 1967, they were federally listed as an endangered species. Over time, the deer population increased and stabilized, but key deer are still listed as endangered because the population is so isolated in a small geographic area. They're only found in the Florida Keys. And about two-thirds of the entire population is on Big Pine Key. A disease outbreak, hurricane, or sea level rise could wipe them out. And threats like continued loss of habitat and high human-related disturbances and mortalities also keep them on the list. I spoke with Nancy Finley, manager of the Florida Keys National Wildlife Refuge Complex, and she described Big Pine Key and National Key Deer Refuge, which is located there.
Fairly unique in that the refuge and the suburban environment all interlap. While there are large tracts of land of the refuge undisturbed, there are also areas where the key deer and the refuge intersect completely. So the species and the public are all in one place, really. Therein lies some of the rub. Familiarity with the species has led to a series of problems.
One interaction that occurs between people and the deer is wildlife feeding. Nancy told us that both residents and visitors are equally part of the problem, and she had this to say.
There may be a slightly higher percentage of people that are residents that may be involved only because of their ability and access over a long period of time, but I think it's also the visitor.
We also spoke with Dave Case from DJ Case & Associates, a communications firm that specializes in environmental and natural resource conservation issues. He's been working with the refuge to develop a communications plan to minimize deer feeding, but more on that in a minute. He describes some ways that people on Big Pine Key unintentionally provide supplemental food, that is, food obtained by wildlife from the public.
There's accidental feeding or inadvertent feeding. It turns out that the deer here have learned to knock over trash cans with garbage in it and jump on the trash cans even if need be in order to get the lid to pop off. And it's not just vegetable matter. They'll even eat, and people commonly say they can see, you know, the deer chewing chicken bones and those kinds of things. If you've, you know, grew up in the north and not had exposure to something like this, you'd never guess that trash exposed, even in trash cans, would be a problem, but it is. And on top of that, of yard waste, if people do landscaping and have yard waste and leave that available for deer, then that's also another thing that attracts them.
So these are sources of food that are unintentionally made available, but people also intentionally feed the deer. By the way, it is illegal to feed key deer, and there are signs along the roadside that say so. And for good reason. In general, wild animals are harmed when people feed them. Feeding can compromise the animal's wildness and its health, and have impacts on the species population, like interfering with the natural processes of selection. Nancy describes some of the other problems that arise from feeding key deer. Some of it has to do with the types of food humans give to the deer.
In some cases, it's things like cracked corn they'll throw out in the yard. And cracked corn in a deer situation with the way their stomachs work, you know, can cause a real bad system with bloat, and they can end up dying from that. Other things are just not nutritionally valuable to deer. I mean, I have photographs and contacts with people where they're feeding them a taco. There's a bag of Dorito chips on deer heads. And it's a shame, but these things persist. They bring the deer closer to roads. Last year in 2014, we had 173 automobile strikes. And you know, this isn't an endangered species. The other thing it causes is it causes the crowding. Animals normally would have, you know, maybe one or two animals in a limited area. So you have an opportunity where a catastrophic disease event could occur because they're crowded. On purpose, they want to be together because there's opportunities for feeding from the community there.
Also, feeding causes the deer population to increase. I know I said feeding didn't typically help animals, and increasing an endangered species population may seem to be helping, but in the long run, no. The population is larger than the environment would normally support, and this causes problems. For one, so many deer can become a nuisance. There are more deer on roads, more deer in people's yards eating their gardens and ornamental plants, and getting into garbage. Nancy told us more about how overpopulation causes problems and increases certain risks. Not just for the deer, but for other species as well.
There's other issues with overbrowse, where the vegetation itself is destroyed. We have over 22 listed species in this refuge, not just key deer. And key deer also browse on some of that material, so we have several listed plant species or candidate species that are of concern. They can affect the marsh rabbit by feeding on vegetation in marsh rabbit habitat. So by having their population artificially inflated, it creates these other problems in the ecosystem.
So there's all these ways that supplemental feeding is not good. It keeps the refuge from meeting their goal of further enhancing the likelihood of long-term survival of key deer by improving its wildness, which Nancy believes improves its resiliency to threats like disease and human-related mortalities over time. When Nancy came to manage the key refuges in 2013, she spent some time trying to define goals and a strategy for key deer management. A wide array of stakeholders, including members of the community, experts, and decisioner policymakers, were convened to work through the Structured Decision-Making, or SDM, process. This involves evaluating the costs and benefits of different actions that could be taken. But they didn't come out of this process with what they thought they would. Here's what they came away with.
The person that was involved in running the SDM workshop was Dr. Dwayne Diefenbach from Penn State University, who is well known in deer management. And after the week-long discussions, Dr. Diefenbach came back to me and said, Nancy, you don't have a deer problem, you have a people problem. And, you know, I don't really vision it as a people problem, but it's a people-deer interaction issue. And so he said very clearly, there isn't much I can do for you because this isn't something that we're going to fix using science necessarily or what we consider the pure science of biology. It's going to take some interactions with the people to solve. As a manager for the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, you come from a biological background and you're trying to look at it from a strictly biological perspective, and the solution isn't there.
So it was this aha moment when they realized that the nature of people's relationships with the deer and human-deer interactions were the major factors underlying the effectiveness of conservation of the species, and they knew they needed to take a different approach. As I mentioned earlier, DJ Case and Associates was contracted to help the refuge develop a communication and public engagement strategy. Dave described the goal of their work and a bit about the process for us.
We started with kind of a communications framework, you know, a process of identification of who are the target audiences, what are the objectives you want to, what do you want them to know, feel, and do, what are the messages that will be persuasive with those audiences, and so on. But we started by doing a workshop where we talked about, first and foremost, what are the motivations? Why would people be feeding deer when it's not a good idea in general to feed wildlife? And specifically, here there are regulations that say you shouldn't do it. What are the motivations that cause them to feed deer? And then how do we use communications to intervene with that?
Right. To change behavior, it helps to understand why the behavior occurs in the first place. Studies have looked at this behavior, and step one was to understand more about the motivations to feed wildlife by looking at that research and literature on the topic, and also by hearing from local people in the community about what they see going on and what they hear from people. Dave tells us about what was learned.
We looked at the literature and talked, you know, looked at why are people willing to in spite of knowing better in many cases, why are they willing to feed? And some of the interesting things that comes out, I mean, not rocket science on one hand, but there's a real strong drive from people to want to help. I mean, we care about wildlife, and of course, a lot of us that work for the Fish and Wildlife Service or work in conservation, that's our motivation. We really care about these things. And so people want to nurture animals. In particular here, you hear the comment a lot in the community that the deer look skinny. And so people are interpreting the deer and saying, well, wow, they need help. So not only I'm inclined to help anyway, but boy, they seem to need it. There must not be enough food for them.
Nancy told us, no, this isn't the case. They have a lot of natural food locally, but public perceptions differ. The fact is that people really love these deer. You read and hear stories about people in the community referring to individual key deer by name, speaking about key deer families and recording their family trees, about instances where people provide first aid to injured deer, they brush and groom the deer, and yes, provide them food and water. The drive to care for and nurture animals is seen as a particularly strong driver for the community residents who engage in these behaviors. It is likely a motivation for tourists as well, but the perception here is that they are mostly motivated by the desire to have an up-close interaction with wildlife. And luring key deer in with food is an easy way to facilitate that and have a thrilling experience, and also a good story to tell your friends and family, and hopefully a great photo that gets lots of likes on Instagram. Children are intrinsically interested in animals as well, and some wildlife feeding may occur when parents want to indulge that and promote their interests. And the motivation to feed deer may also just be a very in-the-moment, impulsive, automatic response, not a thought-out or planned behavior, but an emotional impulse to get near the animal once you see it. As Dave tells us,
these deer have become habituated to people. So as you drive your car and there's one on the roadside, if you pull over to the roadside or stop in the road, the deer will often approach the vehicle because they're used to it. And it's a real hard thing for people to resist, especially if they happen to have children in the car, because there's such a positive response, you know, to children, to animals, so that the deer approach and people respond to that.
Another factor is the role of norms in shaping our behavior. There are different types of norms, descriptive norms, or what everybody else is doing. There's also personal norms, what you usually do or have done in the past, and injunctive norms, what you think other people will think about what you do. And Dave tells us a little bit more about these in relationship to wildlife feeding.
The other thing that we talked about is, you know, kind of what's called normative behaviors, or what's normal for people to do. And in the case of feeding wildlife, I mean, there are bird feeders. In other parts of Florida, it's legal to feed deer. In many parts of the country, it's legal to feed deer. National Elk Range, the Fish and Wildlife Service still feeds elk. And so in lots of places, it's a common practice, or it used to become much more common. The other thing in relation to normative behaviors is this whole idea of people do it because they see other people doing it. And so you have a culture here where people have been allowed, both residents, but also visitors that come to pass through Big Pine Key, they learn that this is a place that you can get close to deer and feed them. And so a lot of people are doing it. In part of our assessment, we found that there's lots of, from our standpoint, inappropriate photographs and communications on social media of people touching and petting and especially feeding key deer. So the fact that that's occurring is a real challenge, because that reinforces other people, hey, this must be okay because other people are doing it.
The other side of the coin is that there just aren't really strong disincentives to not feed key deer, even though feeding them is illegal. As it turns out, enforcing the law is complicated. Nancy explains.
A lot of these deer are being fed on private property. To enforce it on private property adds additional challenge because of their listing status. So it's a Class A misdemeanor, which involves the Assistant U.S. Attorney to prosecute.
So basically what Nancy points out is that because of the deer's endangered status, it makes feeding them a more serious violation and, ironically, harder to actually enforce. So nothing happens. The fear of wild animals can also be a deterrent to human-wildlife interaction, but not so much with key deer. Fed deer tend to appear non-threatening. They approach people and beg and act cute. A study of feeding deer at Shenandoah National Park by Hockett and Hall found that there was a general lack of fear, and visitors believed that it was unlikely that a deer could be dangerous unless they tried to touch it. And in work by Brian and Jansen on the perceptions of wildlife hazards in national parks, they point out that most people recognize that bears may be dangerous. They're large and have sharp teeth and claws. But it's not widely believed that deer, which seem like peaceful creatures, could be dangerous. And still, even with bears, you hear about things like this past fall, when there were problems with people taking bear selfies in South Lake Tahoe. The U.S. Forest Service issued warnings informing people that wild bears are unpredictable and could attack. So, with everything we've just described, how do you get people to change their behavior? Dave describes a key factor for any approach.
The critically important thing that Nancy's doing is engaging the local community. As she mentioned, you know, the refuge is embedded in the community, or the community is embedded in the refuge, both ways. And if in the solutions that we come up with from an information education standpoint have to involve the community in some way.
And the information and education solutions that Dave mentions are informed by theories of behavior change from the field of social psychology. For more on this, see the March newsletter from the HD branch that focuses on the topic of influencing conservation behavior. In addition, there are also studies that have specifically tested the effectiveness of message content and other message factors in relation to wildlife feeding. One of the key takeaways is that social norms matter, and if you communicate about a problem behavior by saying everyone is doing it, you may end up increasing the very behavior you want to curb. Consider a study on the theft of petrified wood in Arizona's Petrified Forest National Park. Visitors were taking more than a ton of wood per month on average. The park erected prominent signs reading, "Your heritage is being vandalized every day by theft losses of petrified wood of 14 tons a year, mostly a small piece at a time." But researchers found that a more effective message was that theft is strongly disapproved. That was more effective than the message that theft is frequent. Back to Dave.
We don't want to emphasize why deer feeding is bad by showing people feeding deer. Because that kind of reinforces that, oh, everyone must be doing it if there's all these pictures of people feeding deer. So we really want, and in terms of local folks, most of the local folks that live on the island do not feed deer. And so we want to emphasize that they're a relatively small number, and we want to continue to try and minimize the amount of activity that takes place among them.
A relatively small number of people can have a big impact, and people who habitually feed wildlife can be particularly challenging to convince to stop. Visitors to the area also add another challenge. How do you reach them with more than a sign along the highway? Here's some thoughts on that from Dave.
Most important thing we can do is both the Fish and Wildlife Service and Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission and the partners is to create their own presence on social media, to take advantage of those avenues, to be sure that if people do searches for key deer, for example, they're more likely to see a video that depicts the how cool it is to see key deer, but that feeding isn't allowed, and here's why.
Another consideration for communication and outreach that Dave described was to celebrate the success of key deer recovery efforts and make people aware of and excited about seeing and protecting them. Interestingly, in the Shenandoah National Park study mentioned earlier, it found that a moral appeal to not feed deer actually detracted from the experience of seeing deer in the park for some people. This was an unintended consequence, and one that they don't want to have happen in the Keys.
You have an endangered mammal that you can observe at pretty close range and pretty easily for people. So it's a really neat opportunity. And so in the course of communicating about a negative associated with that's the feeding part, we want to make sure that we don't denigrate that activity, that we encourage people to view and appreciate what a neat opportunity is to see these deer in a stunning setting like the Florida Keys.
Dave and his colleagues completed a draft key deer feeding communication strategy in early May 2015. It takes all these factors into consideration and includes key messages and specific actions to be taken. It also includes plans to evaluate how effective different actions are, so the refuge can adaptively manage their approaches. As the refuge works with DJ Case and Associates to finalize and implement this strategy, we'll be interested to see how things are going. If you're interested in this or the HD newsletter I mentioned earlier, or anything else HD, email your requests to human_dimensions@fws.gov. I thank you all for listening. This podcast series is a partnership with the Human Dimensions Branch and the National Conservation Training Center. Stay tuned for our next podcast when we'll discuss the human dimensions of wildlife health with Sam Gibbs from our Wildlife Health Office.